Turn to Exodus chapter 3. Exodus chapter 3, we're continuing this series of about walking through the wilderness, of this road to redemption, of walking with God's people out of captivity and into promise. And so it begs the question, where are you headed this summer? What's on your list of places to visit? Jackson, let's see some of these pictures here of some places they might choose to go. You might go to the mountains. We're going to spend some time this coming week in Colorado. We can't wait to see some of these great vistas. Maybe you're going to go to the beach. Maybe you're going to go find that river spot, that cabin that you can stay in, that place that you can fish. Maybe you're going to go to a theme park, or maybe you're just going to go and travel to see family. I'm sorry. Maybe you'll be on a road trip. I'm following along with one of our families here that on Facebook have been posting pictures and updates about being in Washington, D.C., and I just commented, you should have taken me with you. I wanted to go so bad. Wouldn't that be great just to have your family and me in the car? But where do we want to go? We want to go to places like this, places, right, that take our breath away. There's something about the wilderness that calls to us. We long to be moved by beautiful beach sunsets, and maybe we travel to Hawaii, or we want to go to this mountaintop view, and so we hike up the tops of these mountains. Or even this, a couple weeks ago, I took with some of our students, we went to Six Flags, and we went on roller coasters, and it was exciting, and it takes your breath away. And I was explaining roller coasters to my sons. My two sons were with me, and I said, guys, you need to understand something about roller coasters. One, unfortunately, they are completely safe. And I say unfortunately because what we really want to experience is this sense of, I might die when I do this, right? That's the whole idea. And now, fortunately, your brain and your heart and your bowels do not know that this is a completely safe experience. And so you go and your heart races and you're freaking out and you realize that there is an age limit. There should be an age limit on these roller coasters because you get done and then everything is spinning and nothing stops spinning for a while. It's a bit like getting off of one of those, and it's like a toddler being tossed in the air by their dad, and you get off and you feel like, do it again, right? Or I can remember actually climbing some of these mountains. I was a reluctant mountain climber, to say the least. And when I say reluctant, I mean I hated and cursed every step, okay? And seven times, seven mountains, five summits, that's not bad. We made it to the top five out of seven times. And the whole time that we're walking, I could always remember just thinking, because we're walking through the wilderness, through the unmarked trails, and I'm like, there's a road right there. And we could just drive. I've got the keys. We can go back to the van. We can load everybody up. We can drive to the top of this thing, hike maybe a half hour, get up to the top, sing Kumbaya, and everybody will still have the same experience. Or we'd be out in the wilderness, and they would say, now you're going to go, and you're going to spend 3 hours of quiet time, isolated and alone. I'm like, I could have stayed home to do that, right? I could have done that in my garage. I didn't need to come out here and do all of this. And see, for the most part, mountain climbing for me was a very safe experience, even though it takes your breath away, even though you're miserable while you do it. It was safe until one of the very last years that I took a group up. And we went up and we summited, and it was a beautiful day. It was actually one of our better hikes that we'd ever gone on. And we get right up to the top, and you look out, and you sing Kumbaya, and you do the whole thing, and the kids pop their Dr. Peppers, and they drink their Dr. Peppers, and they take 1,000 pictures, and you're excited. And then we saw in the distance storm clouds. Now, I wasn't too worried about this. You see storm clouds, you know, they're a good ways off, you got time. But our guide, she turned to everybody, and I'm not kidding you, the hair on her head stood up on end. She produced an ice axe out of her backpack, threw it away from herself, and said, get off this mountain, because she knew something that the rest of us didn't know, that that storm in those mountains moves faster and would be on us within a matter of minutes. And so kids started descending like rats off a ship, you know, just every man. We had gone up together with buddies, and they're like, save yourselves. And there is, I mean, everybody's getting down because here comes the storm. And one of our students took a really bad spill. And when I say a really bad spill, our group was stretched out about 30 minutes between the front and the back of the pack. And the guy at the very end, at the bottom of the pile, saw this guy fall from the top. And he said, all I could think of was, where are we going to call the helicopter to come get the body? Like, that's what it looked like. It looked to him like certain death. Larry was fine. His face was not. He looked like he had gone about 10 rounds with Tyson, but he was going to be okay. And so... but then also on the way down of trying to get down that mountain, another one of our students, he decided, the genius of the moment, the ignorance of youth, to take an ice path to just slide down because that would be faster, and it was, but he broke his fall with his ankle, which shattered into about 7 different places, and so I had these 2 wounded hikers, and I said to the guides, what are we going to do? Actually on this mountain, there was no trail, Jeep trail to evacuate them out. They said, we've got to hike them out. And so we'll have to put together a special group that can carry these guys out. And I said, you know, somebody should stay back with the rest of the kids. And I'd like to volunteer for that because I'm a giver. That's the kind of person I am. And I pulled aside one of my interns. He had worked for me for 2 years, and I'd known him growing up. He was a great kid, wonderful kid, but he grew up in an urban environment. Do you understand when I say an urban environment? He was a man of color himself, and he had told me the year before and this year while we were walking up the mountain that mountain climbing was stuff white people do. And he was explaining to me that there's a whole list of things that's just for white people. And he says, Jeff, there's a reason why we don't do this. He says, you guys are always out on the beach and you're messing with sharks. And he was telling me all the things, kind of stupid white people things. And so I took Jeremy aside. I said, Jeremy, I've got a special job for you. I need you to hike these kids down the mountain. It's going to take about 7 hours. You're going to have to carry them. You got this group of people. And I said, but I'm going to give you 5 minutes to be mad. I said, it's just me and you. We took him off to the side. I said, you got 5 minutes. Says, all right, Mr. He always called me Mr. Jeff. He said, all right, Mr. Jeff. He said, Mr. Jeff, this is what I'm trying to tell you, white people. This is not safe. He said, you turn your back on this mountain for a minute and it'll kill you. And he went off, and then he got it all back together, and we got the guys down. Larry and Robert are both fine. Their face and their ankle healed. But I'll never forget about the wilderness, that it's the wildness of it that makes it intrinsically dangerous. Some of you didn't notice in those pictures, did you? The bear. Did you see the bear? Did you see the bison? Or did you see the wild horses that were plotting their revenge against their human oppressors, which is why we shouldn't ride horses? It's in the wilderness that we're reminded that God is great, but God has never been safe. Can I say that again? It's in the wilderness that we're reminded that God is great, but God is not safe. Reminds me of that great passage from C.S. Lewis in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Aslan is a lion, the great lion. Ooh, said Susan, I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion. Safe? Said Mr. Beaver. Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you. With that in mind, with the thoughts of the wilderness, with those pictures still playing in your head, let's read this morning's passage. It's a long one, Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 through 15. Now, Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight why the bush does not burn up. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, "Moses, Moses." And Moses said, "Here I am." "Do not come any closer," God said. "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground." And then he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, "I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt, and I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites and Hittites and Amorites and Perizzites and Hivites and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me. I've seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them, so now go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" And God said, "I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain." Moses said to God, "Suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of our fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'Well, what's his name?' Then what shall I tell them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites: 'I am has sent me to you.'" God also said to Moses, "Say to the Israelites, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you.'" So what is it that Moses was supposed to learn in the wilderness? The Bible has a way of cutting out the boring parts of the story. It's a bit like Facebook sometimes. Only show you the good parts, only show you the parts that you might be interested in. Some of you will go on vacation and you will post only pictures to social media of something positive, something good. You will not post the pictures of your kids fighting in the back seat. You won't say, "Here's my kids fighting over who's breathing too loudly." Husbands, you will not post a picture of your wife grabbing the door handle of the car and saying, "Here's my wife grabbing the door handle of the car and gasping every time someone pulls within 100 yards of us on the highway." At least you shouldn't post that. Wives, you won't post video that says, "Oh, look, here's my husband snoring loudly so that I can't sleep. Hashtag best vacation ever." What's missing in between Exodus 2 and Exodus 3? Well, about 40 years of shepherding. 40 years of long, hot, stinky, back-breaking days. The story of Moses usually goes like this. He was a baby in a basket. He grew up with Pharaoh. He saw the burning bush. And then he's parting the Red Sea. And we take out all the difficult times in between. The 40 years for Moses of wilderness started before he ever led anybody out of Egypt. You ever thought about that? He spent that time learning. My friend Chris Seidman, I love it. He says, you know, people always say, when God closes one door, he opens another. He says, but they never tell you how long the hallways are between those two doors. He's absolutely right. There's a long hallway for Moses between killing that slave driver, running to Midian, learning to be a shepherd, going back to Egypt, and telling Pharaoh to let my people go. Some of us are in the hallways. You know, another thing that we can kind of soft pedal as we look at the story of Moses is this whole burning bush idea. We've become pretty blasé about that, haven't we? We say, "Oh well, there, look, you know, look at the, look at this. This is just something kind of a, it should be for us breathtaking." Different kid story, a different trip. Had a bunch of students, like 60 of us, on our way to do service projects all throughout, mission trip all throughout New Mexico and Colorado. And we got to just one of the most beautiful places I'd ever seen. It was the Lincoln National Forest. It's just like everything was gorgeous. And every turn and every time we just turned anywhere, it was like a new postcard. And I looked up, I was driving the people mover, and I looked up into the rearview mirror, and all I could see was tops of heads. This was before phones were even that big of a deal. But all the students were down looking at their Walkmans or iPads or whatever it was that they had, sleeping, reading a book. And I grabbed, they had a little CB, not a radio, but the thing that you could talk to the whole bus with. And I said, look up. I remember shouting that to them, look up and look out the windows. You're missing it. And you could see the looks of their faces change, the expressions change, as they caught the view. And the correct response when you're looking at something is, oh, it's okay to say, oh my God. It's okay to go, oh my God. Because that's what we're seeing. That's Moses' response when he sees this burning bush. It says, and we read it just so quickly, at this, Moses hid his face. I imagine he fell prostrate to the floor, just gets right down level with the ground and says, I can't even look at God. He was afraid to see him. But Moses has a few questions, doesn't he? Moses' first question for God is a great question. Who am I? He says, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And you read that and you think, what's Moses' deal? If God says you need to go, then he thinks you're okay. I don't think this is false humility. I don't think this is Moses needing to hear from God how great he is. I think Moses does not see in himself that what God sees in him. I think God sees something that Moses maybe can't even see. I think it's because Moses knew himself too well. He knew the anger of lashing out and killing somebody in a rage. He knew the embarrassment of hiding for 40 years away from his people. I think his response is a bit like Isaiah in that great passage in Isaiah 6 when Isaiah's sitting in the temple and he has this vision of God and just like the glory of God fills the whole place. And Isaiah says, woe to me, for I am a man of unclean lips and I live among a people of unclean lips. And my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. He says, woe. Moses is right to ask the question, who am I? Because we all fall short. We all fall on our knees. We all fall on our face in front of a God who's that great. But hear this morning, church. God does the most with the people who think the least of themselves. God does the most with the people who think the least of themselves. I love this story. You probably remember this picture. Some of you aren't old enough to have lived through this, but this is a gal by the name of Susan Boyle. There she is. Do you remember her? If you saw her backstage, you would have thought she was maybe just somebody who worked on the set. But she was there for this show called Britain's Got Talent. And she didn't look like much, did she? But here's how she sounded. So what happened to Susan Boyle? Well, she got a standing ovation. She melted the cold, dark heart of Simon Cowell. Even he was moved by this lady singing. She won second place in the competition. Just that video alone was viewed over 100 million times on YouTube. She had an album that was released in November of 2009, sold 8.3 million copies. Why did I tell you her story? Because her story, like Moses, is this story of what the world would look at and say, it's just a bunch of losers. Great servants of the Bible form this long line of unlikely winners. It's the people who think of themselves the least that God can do the most with. Winners that needed a word from the Lord to help them see who they really were. For Moses, it was literally a burning bush. For Jacob, it was a late night wrestling match. For Jonah, it was a message he received in the belly of a fish. For David, he heard it from God through Nathan's heart-wrenching story of betrayal. God has a way of turning lives inside out and upside down and using broken things to make his kingdom whole. Saul sees this blinding light on the road to Damascus. On his way to persecute the church, he hears a message from Christ himself, and it changes Saul from the persecutor to Paul the apostle. But Saul never saw himself more clearly than he did when he was blinded by the light of God. Moses never understands himself more completely than he does in the face of the burning bush. And so how do you see yourself? You may ask that same question. Who am I? I'm old and frumpy. I'm odd. I'm cantankerous. But don't forget the most important descriptor of all about you. You're transformed. You're changed. You're different. For a purpose. The light has come into your life so that you can shine it into others. Like Paul, you have a mission to go tell the world. Like Bethany, you have an appointment, a destiny to go to a place and tell the world about Jesus. Not because you're perfect, but because he is. I love sharing this list. I've shared it in several sermons. I always get asked, somebody will always say, hey, can I have a copy of that? It's not for me. I don't know who put it together. But it reminds us that Moses stuttered, and Abraham was too old. David's armor didn't fit. He was too young, and he had an affair. Timothy had ulcers. Naomi was a widow. Amos's only training was in the school of fig tree pruning. Solomon was too rich, and the widow was too poor. Peter was afraid of death, and Lazarus was actually dead. John was self-righteous, and Jeremiah was depressed and suicidal. Paul was a murderer, so was Moses. Jonah ran from God. Gideon and Thomas both doubted. Elijah was burned out. John the Baptist was a loudmouth. Martha was a worrywart, and Mary was lazy. Samson had long hair, and Noah got drunk. Moses asks such an important question, who am I? And God says, who are you not to go? And then Moses asks a question that's pretty bold. He says, who are you? It's the equivalent. I don't know how many of you raised for good phone etiquette. I still, if I'm at my parents' house and their phone rings, I pick it up and I say, Brooks Residence, Jeffrey speaking. Because that's how we were, that's how we were trained to do it. And when somebody would ask for somebody in the house, we would say what? May I ask who's calling? That is how you, so some of you have learned something new today. But if somebody calls my house and says, I'd like to talk to Rhonda, please. And I say, okay, may I ask who's calling? And they're like, well, who is this? And I'm like, well, this is her husband, the only person you need to know, right? And they're like, well, this is her second husband. I'm like, wait a minute. No. So Moses asks the question to God, may I ask who's calling? When I go and they say, who sent you? Who do I say is calling? And he says, you tell them, the only God who ever was, the only God who ever is, the only God who ever will be. That's what he says when he says, I am who I am. It's a weird tense thing where it's about the past, the present, and the future all together. But God doesn't leave it there, does he? He says, I'm not just the God of the past and the present and the future. I'm the God who changes the future. Romans 4:17. This is a passage that just excites me. And it's in the midst of another lesson that he's talking about Abraham and who's Abraham's seed. And Paul is doing a lot of deep theological work. But just watch what he calls God, how he describes God. He says, as it is written, I made you a father of many nations. He is our father in the sight of God in whom he believed. The God who gives life to the dead and calls into being things that were not. Some of you have a different translation of Romans 17 there. Does it say that he calls things that were not as though they were? Somebody have that? I love that description. God speaks of things that are not as though they were. God spoke of your children before they were even born. God knew your husband before you ever went on the first date. God knew that you would be president of the company before you ever swept the shipping floor. God speaks of things that are not as though they were. He is the God who makes the past, the present, and the future. When you pray to God this week, say to him, say, now God, you're the one who calls into being things that were not, and I need you to call into being some things that are not. I need to ask you to do some things, to create some things that do not exist. God identifies himself as the God of the past, present, and future, but he also says, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. What do those three guys all have in common? Is God saying, well, I'm their God, so if you need a reference, go ask Abraham. Like, go look him up. Or here's some of my previous work. You might know me from such films as... Yada, 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 yada. No. God's not giving his resume here. God's reminding Moses that he's the God of promise. I'm the God who made a promise to Isaac, who kept it to Jacob, who is the God who kept his promise to Jacob. It says in, this is Genesis 15, it says that Abram, this is way, way back, generations before, 400 years before. It says that God tells Abram, know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterwards they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your ancestors in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not reached its full measure. God says, listen, I'm going to keep my promise, but the hallway is going to be really, really long. I'm opening a door 400 years. And we can read this and go, he's doing something thousands of years down the line. God's creating something that we're going to walk through hundreds of years later. He says, I'm the God of promise. But not only that, he says, I'm the God that made you. We have to jump a little bit to Exodus chapter 4. It's the next passage where Moses is telling him all the things that are wrong with him. And there's been some great studies. Some scholars have weighed in to go about the thing about Moses' speech not being good. Some people believe it's that he did not have a great command of the Egyptian language. And so what he's saying is, well, God, there's better emissaries. There's better diplomats to serve to go to talk to Pharaoh's courts. And then others, some of the more reliable Jewish scholars say, no, this is actually about a physical stutter. This is a stammer that Moses had. And so Moses is saying, hey, you have to understand something here. God, I'm not the best person for the job because I've got this speech impediment. And God makes this great statement. He says, who gave human beings their mouth? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I will help you speak and teach you what to say. What God reveals about himself in just that short little passage is that he's a God of the past, present, and future. He's the God of promise, and he's the God who made you. And hear this morning. God did not make a mistake. He didn't leave some unwork finished in you. And you have all of your reasons. I saw it on Facebook the other day. You've given God a million reasons not to love you, and not one of them has convinced him. Isn't that great? You've given God, you've brought all these cases against yourself, and God says, no, that's not it. What does the wilderness teach us? One of my favorite writers, Eugene Peterson, he talks about the time that David, the shepherd boy, spent in the wilderness. He says, the wilderness taught David to see beauty everywhere. The wilderness was David's school in the preciousness of life. Through wilderness testing, David learned to see God in places and things he would have never thought to look previously. This week, I want to encourage you to ask those two questions that Moses asked. Who am I And who are you? Who am I that God would use me? And who is God that he can do something great in me and through me and for me? The next time you're in Rome, maybe that's on your list of places to go this summer. Road trip. If you're ever in Rome, you've got to go to the San Pietro in it's a basilica. It's a church there in Rome, and you'll see this very famous statue. That's the statue of Moses. Do we have some other pictures there, Jackson? Some clothes? There we go. That's the one I wanted you to see. Anybody see what old Moses is sporting on the top of his head? Isn't that weird? Is it a mistake? That's a horned Moses. Why in the world does Moses... notice this too. Okay, good. That's a great one too. Thank you, Jackson. He's got like chiseled biceps. Moses has abs. Like Moses has been on a program. He's working, right? But the horns are believed. Some people think it was a mistranslation of the word Haran, which sounds like it can either mean he grew horns or he radiated light. Now, you biblical scholars here know that when Moses goes up to meet with God on the mountain and he comes back down, he's what? Shining, he's radiating, he's reflecting the light of God. But I love how Michelangelo's like, nope, he had horns. That's what it is. There's something else interesting about this. Go to the other one, Jackson, the one that had the circle on the knee. There it is. It's hard to see. I couldn't get a good picture of this. So we're all going to have to go to Rome together. If you look closely at our left, his right, the right knee of Moses, there's this flaw, this long, narrow indentation. Has anybody ever seen? Some of you are well-traveled. No? Okay. I thought maybe there might be one person who's actually seen this statue, you uncultured swine. Gary! Of course, Gary Williams. You've seen this? And you spoke to it in Italian? You did? Oh, so here's the story. Michelangelo... This is the story. At the end of creating this, was so impressed with his work that he took a hammer and hit the knee like you would a response. And he said, "Why you know a talk?" That's my bad Italian. He said it in Italian. That's the story that's told. I think that's probably apocryphal. But that he actually struck it and was surprised that it didn't speak. Whatever the reason... Michelangelo, in his, they say this is his best sculpture, even better than the sculpture of David, could really not find a better model for imperfection than Moses. Some people think that he left that imperfection in his sculpture for that very reason. Kind of like some of you quilters, we have any quilters in here? They'll intentionally leave a flaw, right, Rhonda, to remind people that nobody's perfect, right? I do that with my barbecue. That's another story. We're reminded that we're filled with flaws and imperfections. But what does God say about us? In Ephesians 2, he says, "For we're God's masterpiece. He's created us anew in Christ Jesus so that we can do the good things he planned for us long ago to do." Sometimes God does the greatest things with the people who think about themselves the least. What does God think of you? God looks at you and he says, "Nope, perfect, just what I intended." And so this week, I want to encourage you to be on the lookout. Spend some time in the wilderness. Maybe you'll be on a road trip. Maybe you'll be driving from monument to monument. Maybe you'll go to the beach or to the mountains or to the rivers or wherever it is that you'll be. But take a moment and learn something in those spaces. Frederick Buechner, another favorite writer of mine, he says this: "Taking your children to school and kissing your wife goodbye, eating lunch with a friend, trying to do a decent day's work, hearing the rain patter against the window, there's no event so commonplace but that God is present within it, always hiddenly, always leaving you room to recognize him or not to recognize him. But all the more fascinatingly, because of that, all the more compellingly and hauntingly, listen to your life. See it for the fathomless mystery that it is. In the boredom and the pain of it, no less than in the excitement and gladness. Touch, taste, smell your way to the holy and hidden heart of it. Because in the last analysis, all moments are key moments, and life itself is grace. As you navigate through your wilderness this week, I pray that you will look for God in the marvelous and in the mundane, that you'll find him in the quiet places and the places that shout for your attention. And may you go and live a life of purpose that God created his masterpiece, you, to do long before you ever knew you were headed back to Egypt. God bless you. Thank you for coming this morning. If you'd like to have somebody pray with you, our elders will be in the back. And if you'd like to be baptized this morning, we'd love for you to do that. Let's stand and sing together.